angel to descend. "Don't loiter, girl. Do you think I shall lose appetite for the meal if you are so long about serving it? No, I shall grow hungrier, more ravenous with each moment, more cruel. Run to me, run! I have a place prepared for your exquisite corpse in my display of flesh." He raised the sword and cut bright segments from the air with it. But still I lingered, although my hopes so recently raised now began to flag. If she is not here by now, her horse must have stumbled on the causeway, have plunged into the sea. One thing only made me glad, that my lover would not see me die. My husband laid my branded forehead on the stone and, as he had done once before, twisted my hair into a rope and drew it away from my neck. "Such a pretty neck," he said, with what seemed to be a genuine retrospective tenderness. "A neck like the stem of a young plant." I felt the silken bristle of his beard and the wet touch of his lips as he kissed my nape. And, once again, of my apparel I must retain only my gems. The sharp blade ripped my dress in two, and it fell from me. A little green moss, growing in the crevices of the mounting block, would be the last thing I should see in all the world. The whiz of that heavy sword. And a great battering and pounding at the gate, the jangling of the bell, the frenzied neighing of a horse. The unholy silence of the place shattered in an instant. The blade did not descend, the necklace did not sever, my head did not roll. For an instant, the beast wavered in his stroke. A sufficient split second of astonished indecision to let me spring upright and dart to the assistance of my lover as he struggled sightlessly with the great bolts that kept her out. The Marquis stood transfixed, utterly dazed, at a loss. It must have been as if he had been watching his beloved Tristan for the 12th, the 13th time, and Tristan stirred, then leapt from his bier in the last act, announced in a jaunty aria interposed from Verdi that bygones were bygones, crying over spilt milk did nobody any good, and, as for himself, he proposed to live happily ever after. The puppet master, open-mouthed, wide-eyed, impotent at last, saw his dolls break free of their strings, abandon the rituals he had ordained for them since time began, and start to live for themselves. The king, aghast, witnesses the revolt of his pawns. "You never saw such a wild thing as my mother, her hat seized by the winds and blown out to sea, so that her hair was her white mane, her black lisle legs exposed to the thigh, her skirts tucked round her waist, one hand on the reins of the rearing horse while the other clasped my father's service revolver, and, behind her, the breakers of the savage, indifferent sea, like the witnesses of a furious justice." And my husband stood stock still, as if she had been Medusa. The sword still raised over his head, as in those clockwork tableaux of Bluebeard that you see in glass cases at fairs. And then it was as though a curious child pushed his centime into the slot and set all in motion. The heavy, bearded figure roared out aloud, braying with fury, and, wielding the honourable sword as if it were a matter of death or glory, charged us, all three. On her 18th birthday, my mother had disposed of a man-eating tiger that had ravaged the villages in the hills north of Hanoi. Now, without a moment's hesitation, she raised my father's gun, took aim, and put a single, irreproachable bullet through my husband's head. We lead a quiet life, the three of us. I inherited, of course, enormous wealth, but we have given most of it away to various charities. The castle is now a school for the blind, though I pray that the children who live there are not haunted by any sad ghosts looking for, crying for, the husband who will never return to the bloody chamber, the contents of which are buried or burned, the door sealed. I felt I had a right to retain sufficient funds to start a little music school here on the outskirts of Paris, and we do well enough. Sometimes we can even afford to go to the opera, though never to sit in a box, of course. We know we are the source of many whisperings and much gossip, but the three of us know the truth of it, and mere chatter can never harm us. I can only bless the, what shall I call it, the maternal telepathy that sent my mother running headlong from the telephone to the station after I had called her that night. "I never heard you cry before," she said, by way of explanation. "Not when you were happy. And whoever cried because of gold bath taps?" The night train, the one I had taken, she lay in her berth, sleepless as I had been. When she could not find a taxi at that lonely halt, she borrowed old Dobbin from a bemused farmer, for some internal urgency told her that she must reach me before the incoming tide sealed me away from her forever. My poor old nurse, left scandalized at home. "What, interrupt Milord on his honeymoon?" She died soon after. She had taken so much secret pleasure in the fact that her little girl had become a marquise. And now, here I was, scarcely a penny the richer, widowed at 17 in the most dubious circumstances, and busily engaged in setting up house with a piano tuner. Poor thing, she passed away in a sorry state of disillusion. But I do believe my mother loves him as much as I do. No paint nor powder, no matter how thick or white, can mask that red mark on my forehead. I am glad he cannot see it, not for fear of his revulsion, since I know he sees me clearly with his heart, but because it spares my shame.
The Courtship of Mr. Leon. Outside her kitchen window, the hedgerow glistened as if the snow possessed a light of its own. When the sky darkened towards evening, an unearthly reflected pallor remained behind on the winter's landscape, while still the soft flakes floated down. This lovely girl, whose skin possesses that same inner light so you would have thought she too was made all of snow, pauses in her chores in the mean kitchen to look out at the country road. Nothing has passed that way all day. The road is white and unmarked as a spilled bolt of bridal satin. Father said he would be home before nightfall. The snow brought down all the telephone wires. He couldn't have called even with the best of news. The roads are bad. I hope he'll be safe. But the old car, stuck fast in a rut, wouldn't budge an inch. The engine whirred, coughed, and died, and he was far from home. Ruined once, then ruined again, as he had learned from his lawyers that very morning. At the conclusion of the lengthy, slow attempt to restore his fortunes, he had turned out his pockets to find the cash for petrol to take him home. And not even enough money left over to buy his beauty, his girl child, his pet, the one white rose she said she wanted. The only gift she wanted, no matter how the case went, how rich he might once again be. She had asked for so little, and he had not been able to give it to her. He cursed the useless car, the last straw that broke his spirit. Then, nothing for it but to fasten his old sheepskin coat around him, abandon the heap of metal and set off down the snow-filled lane to look for help. Behind wrought-iron gates, a short, snowy drive performed a reticent flourish before a miniature, perfect Palladian house that seemed to hide itself shyly behind snow-laden skirts of an antique cypress. It was almost night. That house, with its sweet, retiring, melancholy grace, would have seemed deserted but for a light that flickered in an upstairs window, so vague it might have been the reflection of a star, if any stars could have penetrated the snow that whirled yet more thickly. Chilled through, he pressed the latch of the gate and saw, with a pang, how on the withered ghost of a tangle of thorns there clung still the faded rag of a white rose. The gate clanged loudly shut behind him. Too loudly. For an instant, that reverberating clang seemed final, emphatic, ominous, as if the gate now closed barred all within it from the world outside the walled wintry garden. And from a distance, though from what distance he could not tell, he heard the most singular sound in the world. A great roaring, as of a beast of prey. In too much need to allow himself to be intimidated, he squared up to the mahogany door. This door was equipped with a knocker in the shape of a lion's head, with a ring through the nose. As he raised his hand towards it, it came to him this lion's head was not, as he had thought at first, made of brass, but instead of solid gold. Before, however, he could announce his presence, the door swung silently inward on well-oiled hinges, and he saw a white hall where the candles of a great chandelier cast their benign light upon so many, many flowers in great, free-standing jars of crystal that it seemed the whole of spring drew him into its warmth with a profound intake of perfumed breath. Yet there was no living person in the hall. The door behind him closed as silently as it had opened, yet this time he felt no fear, although he knew by the pervasive atmosphere of suspension of reality that he had entered a place of privilege, where all the laws of the world, he knew, need not necessarily apply. For the very rich are often very eccentric, and the house was plainly that of an exceedingly wealthy man. As it was, when nobody came to help him with his coat, he took it off himself. At that, the crystals of the chandelier tinkled a little, as if emitting a pleased chuckle, and the door of a cloakroom opened of its own accord. There were, however, no clothes at all in this cloakroom. Not even the statutory country house garden mackintosh to greet his own squirrel sheepskin. But when he emerged again into the hall, he found a greeting waiting for him at last. There was, of all things, a liver and white King Charles spaniel, crouched, with head intelligently cocked, on the Kelim runner. It gave him further comforting proof of his unseen host's wealth and eccentricity to see the dog wore, in place of a collar, a diamond necklace. The dog sprang to its feet in welcome and busily shepherded him, how amusing, to a snug little leather-panelled study on the first floor, where a low table was drawn up to a roaring log fire. On the table, a silver tray, round the neck of the whiskey decanter, a silver tag with the legend, "Drink Me," while the cover of the silver dish was engraved with the exhortation, "Eat Me," in a flowing hand. This dish contained sandwiches of thick-cut roast beef, still bloody. He drank the one with soda, and ate the other with some excellent mustard, thoughtfully provided in a stoneware pot. And when the spaniel saw to it he had served himself, she trotted off about her own business. All that remained to make Beauty's father entirely comfortable was to find in a curtained recess not only a telephone but the card of a garage that advertised the 24-hour rescue service. A couple of calls later, and he had confirmed, thank God, there was no serious trouble, only the car's age and the cold weather. Could he pick it up from the village in an hour? And directions to the village, but half a mile away, were supplied in a new tone of deference as soon as he described the house from where he was calling. And he was disconcerted, but, in his impecunious circumstances, relieved to hear the bill would go on his hospitable if absent host's account. No question, assured the mechanic. It was the master's custom. Time for another whiskey as he tried unsuccessfully to call Beauty and tell her he would be late. But the lines were still down, although miraculously the storm had cleared as the moon rose, and now a glance between the velvet curtains revealed a landscape as of ivory with an inlay of silver. Then the spaniel appeared again, with his hat in her careful mouth, prettily wagging her tail as if to tell him it was time to be gone, that this magical hospitality was over. As the door swung to behind him, he saw the lion's eyes were made of agate. Great wreaths of snow now precariously curded the rose trees, and when he brushed against a stem on his way to the gate, a chill armful softly thudded to the ground to reveal, as if miraculously preserved beneath it, one last single perfect rose that might have been the last rose left living in all the white winter, and of so intense and yet delicate a fragrance, it seemed to ring like a dulcimer on the frozen air. How could his host, so mysterious, so kind, deny Beauty her present? Not now distant, but close at hand, close as that mahogany front door, rose a mighty, furious roaring. The garden seemed to hold its breath in apprehension. But still, because he loved his daughter, Beauty's father stole the rose. At that, every window of the house blazed with furious light, and a fugal baying, as of a pride of lions, introduced his host. There is always a dignity about great bulk, an assertiveness, a quality of being more there than most of us are. The being who now confronted Beauty's father seemed to him in his confusion vaster than the house he owned, ponderous yet swift, and the moonlight glittered on his great mazy head of hair, on the eyes green as agate, on the golden hairs of the great paws that grasped his shoulders, so that their claws pierced the sheepskin as he shook him, like an angry child shakes a doll. This leonine apparition shook Beauty's father until his teeth rattled, and then dropped him, sprawling on his knees, while the spaniel, darting from the open door, danced round them, yapping distractedly, like a lady at whose dinner party blows have been exchanged.
"My good fellow," stammered Beauty's father.
But the only response was a renewed roar.
"Good fellow. I am no good fellow. I am the Beast, and you must call me Beast, while I call you Thief."
"Forgive me for robbing your garden, Beast."
Head of a lion, mane and mighty paws of a lion, he reared on his hind legs like an angry lion, yet wore a smoking jacket of dull red brocade, and was the owner of that lovely house and the low hills that cupped it.
"It was for my daughter," said Beauty's father. "All she wanted in the whole world was one white, perfect rose."
The Beast rudely snatched the photograph her father drew from his wallet and inspected it, first brusquely, then with a strange kind of wonder, almost the dawning of surmise. The camera had captured a certain look she had, sometimes, of absolute sweetness and absolute gravity, as if her eyes might pierce appearances and see your soul. When he handed the picture back, the beast took good care not to scratch the surface with his claws.
"Take her the roast, then. But bring her to dinner," he growled. And what else was there to be done?
Although her father had told her of the nature of the one who waited for her, she could not control an instinctual shudder of fear when she saw him. For a lion is a lion, and a man is a man. And though lions are more beautiful by far than we are, yet they belong to a different order of beauty. And besides, they have no respect for us. Why should they? Yet wild things have a far more rational fear of us than is ours of them, and some kind of sadness in his agate eyes, that looked almost blind, as if sick of sight, moved her heart. He sat, impassive as a figurehead at the top of the table. The dining room was Queen Anne, tapestried, a gem. Apart from an aromatic soup kept hot over a spirit lamp, the food, though exquisite, was cold. A cold bird, a cold souffle, cheese. He asked her father to serve them from a buffet, and himself ate nothing. He grudgingly admitted, what she had already guessed, that he disliked the presence of servants because she thought a constant human presence would remind him too bitterly of his otherness. But the spaniel sat at his feet throughout the meal, jumping up from time to time to see that everything was in order. How strange he was. She found his bewildering difference from herself almost intolerable. Its presence choked her. There seemed a heavy, soundless pressure upon her in his house, as if it lay under water. And when she saw the great paws lying on the arm of his chair, she thought, they are the death of any tender herbivore. And such a one she felt herself to be, Miss Lamb, spotless, sacrificial. Yet she stayed and smiled, because her father wanted her to do so. And when the beast told her how he would aid her father's appeal against the judgment, she smiled with both her mouth and her eyes. But when, as they sipped their brandy, the beast, in the diffuse rumbling purr with which he conversed, suggested with a hint of shyness, of fear of refusal, that she should stay here with him, in comfort, while her father returned to London to take up the legal cudgels again, she forced a smile. For she knew with a pang of dread, as soon as he spoke, that it would be so, and her visit to the beast must be on some magically reciprocal scale, the price of her father's good fortune. Do not think she had no will of her own. Only she was possessed by a sense of obligation to an unusual degree, and besides, she would gladly have gone to the ends of the earth for her father, whom she loved dearly. Her bedroom contained a marvellous glass bed. She had a bathroom with towels thick as fleece, and vials of suave unguents, and a little parlour of her own, the walls of which were covered with an antique paper of birds of paradise and Chinamen, where there were precious books and pictures, and the flowers grown by invisible gardeners in the beast's hothouses. Next morning, her father kissed her and drove away with a renewed hope about him that made her glad. But all the same, she longed for the shabby home of their poverty. The unaccustomed luxury about her she found poignant, because it gave no pleasure to its possessor, and himself she did not see all day, as if, curious reversal, she frightened him. although the spaniel came and sat with her to keep her company. Today, the spaniel wore a neat choker of turquoises. Who prepared her meals? Loneliness of the beast. All the time she stayed there, she saw no evidence of another human presence but the trays of food that arrived on a dumb waiter inside a mahogany cupboard in her parlour. Dinner was eggs benedict and grilled veal. She ate it as she browsed in a book she had found in the rosewood revolving bookcase, a collection of courtly and elegant French fairy tales about white cats who were transformed princesses and fairies who were birds. Then she pulled a sprig of muscat grapes from a fat bunch for her dessert and found herself yawning. She discovered she was bored. At that, the spaniel took hold of her skirt with its velvet mouth and gave it a firm but gentle tug. She allowed the dog to trot before her to the study in which her father had been entertained, and there, to her well-disguised dismay, she found her host, seated beside the fire, with a tray of coffee at his elbow from which she must pour. The voice that seemed to issue from a cave full of echoes, his dark, soft, rumbling growl. After her day of pastel-coloured idleness, how could she converse with the possessor of a voice that seemed an instrument created to inspire the terror that the chords of great organs bring? Fascinated, almost awed, she watched the firelight play on the gold fringes of his mane. He was irradiated, as if with a kind of halo, and she thought of the first great beast of the apocalypse, the winged lion with his paw upon the gospel, St. Mark. Small talk turned to dust in her mouth. Small talk had never, at the best of times, been Beauty's forte, and she had little practice at it. But he, hesitantly, as if he himself were in awe of a young girl who looked as if she had been carved out of a single pearl, asked after her father's law case, and her dead mother, and how they, who had been so rich, had come to be so poor. He forced himself to master his shyness, which was that of a wild creature, and so she contrived to master her own. To such effect, that soon she was chattering away to him, as if she had known him all her life. When the little cupid in the gilt clock on the mantelpiece struck its miniature tambourine, she was astonished to discover it did so 12 times.
"So late. You will want to sleep," he said.
At that, they both fell silent, as if these strange companions were suddenly overcome with embarrassment to find themselves together alone in that room in the depths of the winter's night. As she was about to rise, he flung himself at her feet and buried his head in her lap. She stayed stock still, transfixed. She felt his hot breath on her fingers, the stiff bristles of his muzzle grazing her skin, the rough lapping of his tongue, and then, with a flood of compassion, understood. "All he is doing is kissing my hands." He drew back his head and gazed at her with his green, inscrutable eyes, in which she saw her face repeated twice, as small as if it were in bud. Then, without another word, he sprang from the room, and she saw with an indescribable shock he went on all fours. Next day, all day, the hills on which the snow still settled echoed with the beast's rumbling roar. "Has Master gone a-hunting?" Beauty asked the spaniel. But the spaniel growled, almost bad-temperedly, as if to say that she would not have answered even if she could have. Beauty would pass the day in her suite reading or perhaps doing a little embroidery. A box of coloured silks and a frame had been provided for her. All well wrapped up, she wandered in the walled garden, among the leafless roses, with the spaniel at her heels, and did a little raking and rearranging. An idle, restful time. A holiday. The enchantment of that bright, sad, pretty place enveloped her, and she found that, against all her expectations, she was happy there. She no longer felt the slightest apprehension at her nightly interviews with the beast. All the natural laws of the world were held in suspension here, where an army of invisibles tenderly waited on her, and she would talk with the lion, under the patient chaperonage of her brown-eyed dog, on the nature of the moon, and its borrowed light, about the stars and the substances of which they were made, about the variable transformations of the weather. Yet still his strangeness made her shiver, and when he helplessly fell before her to kiss her hands as he did every night when they parted, she would retreat nervously into her skin, flinching at his touch. The telephone shrilled for her. Her father. Such news. The beast sunk his great head onto his paws. You will come back to me. It will be lonely here, without you. She was moved almost to tears that he should care for her so. It was in her heart to drop a kiss upon his shaggy mane, but though she stretched out her hand towards him, she could not bring herself to touch him of her own free will. He was so different from herself. But yes, she said, I will come back. Soon, before the winter is over. Then the taxi came and took her away. You are never at the mercy of the elements in London, where the huddled warmth of humanity melts the snow before it has time to settle, and her father was as good as rich again, since his hirsute friends, lawyers, had the business so well in hand that his credit brought them nothing but the best. A resplendent hotel, the opera, theatres, a whole new wardrobe for his darling, so she could step out on his arm, to parties, to receptions, to restaurants. And life was as she had never known it, for her father had ruined himself before her birth killed her mother. Although the beast was the source of this new-found prosperity, and they talked of him often, now that they were so far away from the timeless spell of his house, it seemed to possess the radiant and finite quality of a dream, and the beast himself, so monstrous, so benign, some kind of spirit of good fortune who had smiled on them and let them go. She sent him flowers, white roses in return for the ones he had given her, and when she left the florist, she experienced a sudden sense of perfect freedom, as if she had just escaped from an unknown danger, had been grazed by the possibility of some change, but finally left intact. Yet with this exhilaration, a desolating emptiness. But her father was waiting for her at the hotel. They had planned a delicious expedition to buy her furs, and she was as eager for the treat as any girl might be. Since the flowers in the shop were the same all year round, nothing in the window could tell her that winter had almost gone. Returning late from supper after the theatre, she took off her earrings in front of the mirror. Beauty. She smiled at herself with satisfaction. She was learning, at the end of her adolescence, how to be a spoiled child, and that pearly skin of hers was plumping out a little, with high living and compliments. A certain inwardness was beginning to transform the lines around her mouth, those signatures of the personality, and her sweetness and her gravity could sometimes turn a mite petulant when things were not quite as she wanted them to go. You could not have said that her freshness was fading, but she smiled at herself in mirrors a little too often these days, and the face that smiled back was not quite the one she had seen contained in the beast's agate eyes. Her face was acquiring, instead of beauty, a lacquer of the invincible prettiness that characterizes certain pampered, exquisite, expensive cats. The soft wind of spring breathed in from the nearby park through the open windows. She did not know why it made her want to cry. There was a sudden, urgent, scrabbling sound, as of claws at her door. Her trance before the mirror broke. All at once she remembered everything perfectly. Spring was here, and she had broken her promise. Now the beast himself had come in pursuit of her. First, she was frightened of his anger. Then, mysteriously joyful, she ran to open the door. But it was his liver and white spotted spaniel, who hurled herself into the girl's arms in a flurry of little barks and gruff murmurings of whimpering and relief. Yet where was the well-brushed, jeweled dog who had sat beside her embroidery frame in the parlour with birds of paradise nodding on the walls? This one's fringed ears were matted with mud. Her coat was dusty and snarled. She was thin as a dog that had walked a long way, and if she had not been a dog, she would have been in tears. After that first rapturous greeting, she did not wait for Beauty to order her food and water. She seized the chiffon hem of her evening dress, whimpered and tugged, threw back her head, howled, then tugged and whimpered again. There was a slow, late train that would take her to the station where she had left for London 3 months ago. Beauty scribbled a note for her father, threw a coat round her shoulders. "Quickly, quickly," urged the spaniel soundlessly, and Beauty knew the beast was dying. In the thick dark before dawn, the station master roused a sleepy driver for her. "Fast as you can." It seemed December still possessed his garden. The ground was hard as iron. The skirts of the dark cypress moved on the chill wind with a mournful rustle, and there were no green shoots on the roses as if this year they would not bloom. And not one light in any of the windows, only in the topmost attic, the faintest smear of radiance on a pane, the thin ghost of a light on the verge of extinction. The spaniel had slept a little in her arms, for the poor thing was exhausted. But now her grieving agitation fed Beauty's urgency, and as the girl pushed open the front door, she saw, with a thrust of conscience, how the golden door knocker was thickly muffled in black crepe. The door did not open silently as before, but with a doleful groaning of the hinges, and this time onto perfect darkness. Beauty clicked her gold cigarette lighter. The tapers in the chandelier had drowned in their own wax, and the prisms were wreathed with drifting arabesques of cobwebs. The flowers in the glass jars were dead, as if nobody had had the heart to replace them after she was gone. Dust everywhere, and it was cold. There was an air of exhaustion, of despair in the house, and worse, a kind of physical disillusion, as if its glamour had been sustained by a cheap conjuring trick, and now the conjurer, having failed to pull the crowds, had departed to try his luck elsewhere. Beauty found a candle to light her way, and followed the faithful spaniel up the staircase, past the study, past her suite, through a house echoing with desertion, up a little back staircase dedicated to mice and spiders, stumbling, ripping the hem of her dress in her haste. What a modest bedroom. An attic with a sloping roof. They might have been given the chambermaid if the beast had employed staff. A nightlight on the mantelpiece. No curtains at the windows. No carpet on the floor, and a narrow iron bedstead on which he lay, sadly diminished, his bulk scarcely disturbing the faded patchwork quilt, his mane a greyish rat's nest, and his eyes closed. On the stick-back chair where his clothes had been thrown, The roses she had sent him were thrust into the jug from the washstand, but they were all dead. The spaniel jumped up on the bed and burrowed her way under the scanty covers, softly keening.
"O beast," said Beauty, "I have come home."
His eyelids flickered. How was it she had never noticed before that his agate eyes were equipped with lids, like those of a man? Was it because she had only looked at her own face reflected there?
"I'm dying, Beauty," he said in a cracked whisper of his former purr. "Since you left me, I have been sick. I could not go hunting. I found I had not the stomach to kill the gentle beasts. I could not eat. I am sick and I must die. But I shall die happy because you have come to say goodbye to me."
She flung herself upon him, so that the iron bedstead groaned and covered his poor paws with her kisses.
"Don't die, beast. If you'll have me, I'll never leave you."
When her lips touched the meat hook claws, they drew back into their pads, and she saw how he had always kept his fists clenched, but now, painfully, tentatively, at last began to stretch his fingers. Her tears fell on his face like snow, and under their soft transformation, the bones showed through the pelt, the flesh through the wide, tawny brow, and then it was no longer a lion in her arms, but a man. A man with an unkempt mane of hair, and how strange, a broken nose, such as the noses of retired boxers, that gave him a distant, heroic resemblance to the handsomest of all the beasts.
"Do you know," said Mr. Leon, "I think I might be able to manage a little breakfast today, Beauty, if you would eat something with me."
Mr. and Mrs. Leon walk in the garden. The old spaniel drowses on the grass, in a drift of fallen petals.
The Tiger's Bride. My father lost me to the beast at cards. There's a special madness strikes travellers from the north when they reach the lovely land where the lemon trees grow. We come from countries of cold weather. At home, we're at war with nature. But here, you think you've come to the blessed plot where the lion lies down with the lamb. Everything flowers. No harsh wind stirs the voluptuous air. The sun spills fruit for you, and the deathly, sensual lethargy of the sweet south infects the starved brain. It gasps, "Luxury! More luxury!" But then the snow comes. You cannot escape it. It followed us from Russia as if it ran behind our carriage, and in this dark, bitter city has caught up with us at last, flocking against the window panes to mock my father's expectations of perpetual pleasure as the veins in his forehead stand out and throb, his hands shake as he deals the devil's picture books. The candles dropped hot, acrid gouts of wax on my bare shoulders. I watched with a furious cynicism peculiar to women whom circumstances force mutely to witness folly, while my father, fired in his desperation by more and yet more draughts of the firewater they call grappa, rids himself of the last scraps of my inheritance. When we left Russia, we owned black earth, blue forest with bear and wild boar, serfs, cornfields, farmyards, my beloved horses, white nights of cool summer, the fireworks of the northern lights. what a burden all those possessions must have been to him, because he laughs as if with glee as he beggars himself. He is in such a passion to donate all to the beast. Everyone who comes to this city must play a hand with the Grand Seigneur. Few come. They did not warn us at Milan, or if they did, we did not understand them. My limping Italian, the bewildering dialect of the region. Indeed, I myself spoke up in favour of this remote provincial place, out of fashion 200 years, because, oh irony, it boasted no casino. I did not know that the price of a stay in its decembral solitude was a game with Milord. The hour was late. The chill damp of this place creeps into the stones, into your bones, into the spongy pith of the lungs. It insinuated itself with a shiver into our parlour, where Milord came to play in the privacy essential to him. Who could refuse the invitation his valet brought to our lodging? Not my profligate father, certainly. The mirror above the table gave me back his frenzy, my impassivity, the withering candles, the emptying bottles, the coloured tide of the cards as they rose and fell, the still mask that concealed all the features of the beast but for the yellow eyes that strayed now and then from his unfurled hand towards myself.
La bestia!
Said our landlady, gingerly fingering an envelope with his huge crest of a tiger rampant on it, something of fear, something of wonder in her face, and I could not ask her why they called the master of the place La Bestia. Was it to do with that heraldic signature? Because her tongue was so thickened by the phlegmy, bronchitic speech of the region, I scarcely managed to make out a thing she said, except when she saw me.
Che bella!
Since I could toddle, always the pretty one, with my glossy, nut-brown curls, my rosy cheeks, and born on Christmas Day, her Christmas Rose, my English nurse called me, the peasants said, the living image of her mother, crossing themselves out of respect for the dead. My mother did not blossom long. Bartered for her dowry to such a feckless sprig of the Russian nobility that she soon died of his gaming, his whoring, his agonizing repentances. And the beast gave me the rose from his own impeccable, if outmoded, buttonhole when he arrived, the valet brushing the snow off his black cloak. This white rose, unnatural, out of season, that now my nervous fingers ripped, petal by petal, apart as my father magnificently concluded the career he had made of catastrophe. This is a melancholy, introspective region, a sunless, featureless landscape, the sullen river sweating fog, the shorn hunkering willows, and a cruel city. The sombre piazza, a place uniquely suited to public executions, under the beetling shadow of that malign barn of a church. They used to hang condemned men in cages from the city walls. Unkindness comes naturally to them. Their eyes are set too close together. They have thin lips. Poor food, pasta soaked in oil, boiled beef with sauce of bitter herbs. A funereal hush about the place. The inhabitants huddled up against the cold so you can hardly see their faces. And they lie to you and cheat you. Innkeepers, coachmen, everybody. God, how they fleeced us! The treacherous south, where you think there is no winter, but forget you take it with you. My senses were increasingly troubled by the fuddling perfume of Milord, far too potent a reek of purplish civet at such close quarters in so small a room. He must bathe himself in scent, soak his shirts and underlinen in it. What can he smell of that needs so much camouflage? I never saw a man so big look so two-dimensional, in spite of the quaint elegance of the beast, in the old-fashioned tailcoat that might, from its looks, have been bought in those distant years before he imposed seclusion on himself. He does not feel he need keep up with the times. There is a crude clumsiness about his outlines that are on the ungainly, giant side. And he has an odd air of self-imposed restraint, as if fighting a battle with himself to remain upright when he would far rather drop down on all fours. He throws our human aspirations to the godlike, sadly awry poor fellow. Only from a distance would you think the beast not much different from any other man. Although he wears a mask with a man's face painted most beautifully on it. Oh yes, a beautiful face, but one with too much formal symmetry of feature to be entirely human. One profile of his mask is the mirror image of the other. Too perfect. Uncanny. He wears a wig, too, false hair tied at the nape with a bow, a wig of the kind you see in old-fashioned portraits. A chaste silk stock stuck with a pearl hides his throat, and gloves of blonde kid that are yet so huge and clumsy they do not seem to cover hands. He is a carnival figure made of papier-mâché and crepe hair, and yet he has the devil's knack at cards. His masked voice echoes as from a great distance as he stoops over his hand, and he has such a growling impediment in his speech that only his valet, who understands him, can interpret for him, as if his master were the clumsy doll and he the ventriloquist. The wick slumped in the eroded wax. The candles guttered. By the time my rose had lost all its petals, my father, too, was left with nothing.
Except the girl.
Gambling is a sickness. My father said he loved me, yet he staked his daughter on a hand of cards. He fanned them out. In the mirror, I saw wild hope light up his eyes. His collar was unfastened. His rumpled hair stood up on end. He had the anguish of a man in the last stages of debauchery. The draughts came out of the old walls and bit me. I was colder than I'd ever been in Russia, when nights are coldest there. A queen, a king, an ace. I saw them in the mirror. Oh, I know he thought he could not lose me. Besides, back with me would come all he had lost, the unravelled fortunes of our family at one blow restored. And would he not win as well the beast's hereditary palazzo outside the city, his immense revenues, his lands around the river, his rents, his treasure chest, his mantegnas, his Giulio Romanos, his Cellini salt cellars, his titles, the very city itself? You must not think my father valued me at less than a king's ransom, but at no more than a king's ransom. It was cold as hell in the parlour, and it seemed to me, child of the severe north, that it was not my flesh, but truly my father's soul that was in peril. My father, of course, believed in miracles. What gambler does not? In pursuit of just such a miracle as this, had we not travelled from the land of bears and shooting stars? So we teetered on the brink. The beast bayed, laid down all three remaining aces. The indifferent servants now glided smoothly forward as on wheels to douse the candles one by one. To look at them, you would think that nothing of any moment had occurred. They yawned a little resentfully. It was almost morning. We had kept them out of bed. The beast's man brought his cloak. My father sat amongst these preparations for departure, staring on at the betrayal of his cards upon the table. The beast's man informed me crisply that he, the valet, would call for me and my bags tomorrow at 10 and conduct me forthwith to the beast's palazzo. Capisco? So shocked was I that I scarcely did capisco. He repeated my orders patiently. He was a strange, thin, quick little man who walked with an irregular, jolting rhythm upon splayed feet in curious wedge-shaped shoes. Where my father had been red as fire, now he was white as the snow that caked the windowpane. His eyes swam. Soon he would cry. "Like the base Indian," he said. He loved rhetoric. "One whose hand, like the base Indian, threw a pearl away, richer than all his tribe. I have lost my pearl beyond price." At that, the beast made a sudden, dreadful noise, halfway between a growl and a roar. The candles flared. The quick valet, the prim hypocrite, interpreted unblinking. "My master says, if you are so careless of your treasures, you should expect them to be taken from you." He gave us the bow and smile his master could not offer us, and they departed. I watched the snow until, just before dawn, it stopped falling. A hard frost settled. Next morning, there was a light like iron. The beast's carriage, of an elegant, if antique, design, was black as a hearse, and it was drawn by a dashing black gelding who blew smoke from his nostrils and stamped upon the packed snow with enough sprightly appearance of life to give me some hope that not all the world was locked in ice, as I was. I had always held a little towards Gulliver's opinion that horses are better than we are, and that day I would have been glad to depart with him to the kingdom of horses if I'd been given the chance. The valet sat up on the box in a natty black and gold livery, clasping, of all things, a bunch of his master's damned white roses, as if a gift of flowers would reconcile a woman to any humiliation. He sprang down with preternatural agility to place them ceremoniously in my reluctant hand. My tear-beslobbered father once arose to show that I forgive him. When I break off a stem, I prick my finger, and so he gets his rose all smeared with blood. The valet crouched at my feet to tuck the rugs about me with a strange kind of unflattering obsequiousness, yet he forgot his station sufficiently to scratch busily beneath his white periwig with an oversupple index finger, as he offered me what my old nurse would have called an old-fashioned look, ironic, sly, a smidgen of disdain in it. And pity? No pity. His eyes were moist and brown. His face seamed with the innocent cunning of an ancient baby. He had an irritating habit of chattering to himself under his breath all the time as he packed up his master's winnings. I drew the curtains to conceal the sight of my father's farewell. My spite was sharp as broken glass. Lost to the beast! And what, I wondered, might be the exact nature of his beastliness? My English nurse once told me about a tiger man she saw in London when she was a little girl to scare me into good behaviour. For I was a wild wee thing, and she could not tame me into submission with a frown or the bribe of a spoonful of jam. "If you don't stop plaguing the nursemaids, my beauty, the tiger man will come and take you away." They'd brought him from Sumatra in the Indies, she said. His hinder parts were all hairy, and only from the head downwards did he resemble a man. And yet the beast goes always masked. It cannot be his face that looks like mine. But the tiger man, in spite of his hairiness, could take a glass of ale in his hand like a good Christian and drink it down. had she not seen him do so at the sign of the George by the steps of Upper Moorfields when she was just as high as me and lisped and toddled too. Then she would sigh for London,